You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It has been 1 year since Governor Brad Little took his oath of office on the steps of the Capitol. The rancher and longtime elected official told the crowd that day that his goal would be to, quote, reflect shared Idaho values. In his first few months in office, he implemented legislation raising teacher minimum salary to $40,000 a year. He also increased funding towards literacy. And as the legislative session went on, he vetoed stricter requirements to get a citizens initiative on the ballot. And as he prepares for year number two as Idaho's top leader, we are sitting down with him to talk about his time in office so far and to also look ahead to the future. Welcome and thank you for coming into the studio today.
It's great to be here.
Let's start with education, as I mentioned, because you came into office on a platform that focused on education. So how do you think that focus went this first year?
Well, I was pleased with several initiatives, opportunity scholarships for more affordable college, literacy, almost a doubling of what we invest in literacy, and then starting teacher pay. There were some other things, but those were the three big ones that I had to work on the legislature a little bit, but they passed overwhelmingly, and we made a good case to the legislature. And as I traveled the state since the legislature's been out, and of course the funding didn't take effect until the 1st of July, but we're seeing great progress in a lot of school districts on literacy. And if we're going to spend half our money on education, these kids ought to be able to read.
You know, speaking of literacy, we had Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News on the program a couple weeks
back. I've heard
of him. You've heard of him. You might know who he is. Yeah. He follows you around asking education questions. He is delving into the literacy issues in the state of Idaho and looking back on this, on where we are when it comes to reading levels, especially in the third grade. And yes, we've seen some districts do better, but we're still not, as data is showing, where, not the majority of third graders are reading at a third grade level. In your opinion, is it just about putting more money towards this, or do we need to be changing culture? What else do we need to be doing?
Well, first off, I mean, if you put a dollar into the program, and the dollar didn't start until September, mm-hmm. so it's a little hard to put money into it in September, and you know we're just getting data back from a month later, and say we've created a miracle. Some of the school districts have been using the IRI as a way to gauge their reading proficiency of their kids. You know, what are the problems? What do you need to address? Some districts have just started that. Others have piloted it or in their third year. So we should not be too hasty to see what the results are, but there are some incredible results. I mean, some of these districts that have a lot of English language learners, a lot of kids that are free and reduced lunch, kids that come from a more impoverished background are making incredible progress. And so the school districts that are maybe not making quite as fast are looking to their neighboring districts, maybe even in the same district, neighboring schools, and say, what can we do? That's what we expect. The solution in NOTUS is not the solution in Rexburg. And we have to customize what we do in literacy to the demographics and the kids that are in those schools.
You created a 26-person task force on K-12 education. How is that process going? But also, what are you hoping to accomplish in 2020 with this task force?
Well, I was delighted that they didn't overload us. Literacy, college and career ready, what we do on teacher pipeline, some of these social-emotional challenges that some of these kids have. They really had a very limited number of recommendations, and that's something we can get done. And, you know, it was good buy-in. There were a few no votes, but for the most part, and those were somewhat philosophical votes rather than that they didn't think that those were the things we should do. So I was very pleased.
Let's switch to higher education now, because you've asked the state agencies, including universities, to trim their budget by 1% this year and then 2% next year. At the same time, though, we want to get more students to attain some level of higher education, and that's one of the big goals of the state right now. So you have said that you want Idaho students to stay in Idaho. How do you basically square those budget cuts with universities with attaining that higher education goal?
Well, last year we put in $7 million more in opportunity scholarships, and I don't have the numbers right off the top of my head, but the waiting list of kids getting those opportunity scholarships has gone way down. We've got way more kids that are going to school because we're offering, particularly students with a higher level of needs, we're addressing that. As you said, every state agency did a 1% this year and a 2% for next year. And we gave them a heads up way early so they could, it wasn't like a crisis cut at them in the middle of the year or the end of the year. We gave them, we send the signal early that, and a lot of this is because almost every state miscalculated what their revenue was going to be because of the federal tax code. We adopted, as we almost always do, the federal tax code, and that created a bit of a funding shortfall, and we wanted to address it early and make sure that we didn't have a bigger wreck later, that we didn't have a, you know, a 3% in the middle of the year, which is 6 or 7%, and that's why we did that.
How do you feel about all four of the university presidents coming together and saying they're going to do a tuition freeze this year?
Well, I mean, I think it's a good signal. We want students to if they're at a fork in the road as a high school senior, a fork in the road about going out and getting a job or going on to college, whether it be community college or whether it be our four-year institutions, we want them to know there's going to be some certainty to what their fees and tuition are going to be, and that's a great message. There's going to be some challenges, but the fact that we did it early, the fact that the institutions are working together, we're trying to make sure that some of these programs can be done more efficiently. The Huron report, which was done 2 years ago, talked about that all our colleges and universities need to not duplicate backroom, lawyers, architects, payroll systems, that there was a lot of money that could be saved there if we eliminated the duplication in some of the backroom functions. Obviously, here at Boise, you know, the education college, the business college, the materials science college, we want those to be as robust and as efficient as possible. Some of these other programs, we can save overhead by having the common thing done at all the institutions.
We're speaking with Idaho Governor Brad Little, talking about his first year in office and also looking ahead. So back in August, Governor, as you know, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled against you and the state in the case of Adrea Edmo. And if people aren't familiar who she is a transgender prisoner in Idaho, and she is seeking gender reassignment surgery. She's been diagnosed with gender dysphoria by state-paid doctors. Now, you and the state, you challenged that ruling, asking the Supreme Court to take up that case. They have not done so at this point. But why is it so important to fight this case, even with two lower court rulings coming in against the state?
Well, part of the issue, Gemma, is that is not uniform across the country. Some federal courts have ruled opposite, and that's why we think it really does need to be addressed at the Supreme Court level. We are not at the Supreme Court level because I asked, and we are asking the Ninth to, for the entire Ninth Circuit to look at it, en banc is what they call it. And then after they address it en banc, then we'll have a better opportunity. But when I talk to other governors, when I talk to other areas, this is a issue. We're not denying the diagnosis for the inmate. We're saying is if are we going to establish a precedent that's going to have significant long-term consequences going forward, and that's where this is, as you well know, and you've reported on it. Some of the preparatory work is being done for the inmate at this point in time.
I mean, we've heard that some people believe that this is a waste of taxpayer money by going forward with this surgery, but when our investigative podcast Locked dug into this, we did find that the state's current contract with Corizon would actually cover the surgery without added cost to the taxpayer. So does it continue to make sense to continue to fight this when we know that it's not going to come right out of taxpayer taxpayers' money. Do you know what I'm saying?
Well, I think the rest of the story is if you're an insurance carrier and you contract to provide services and a new one comes up, obviously they have to cover it. But that means the next time they bid the contract, they're going to bid it at a higher level.
And this is this one of the reasons to continue this fight? But it's also because, as you said, there's no uniformity across the country.
Exactly. And, you know, occasionally we'll have an inmate, we'll have somebody that was let out of prison in one jurisdiction and comes to Idaho and offends and ends up in our system. Uniformity and some of these big issues needs to be addressed.
I want to talk about the proposal to have stricter requirements to get a citizens initiative on the ballot. You ended up vetoing that, and I would say you made some of your Republican colleagues not so happy with that veto.
That's true.
Why did you decide to veto it?
Well, I had messaged that as technology changes, as communication changes, as populations change, we have adjusted how we put an initiative on the ballot multiple times over the years. And I don't have a problem with looking at it and making sure it's fair. That particular bill had so many different components in it, in how the, you know, what the population was, how many districts, that it looked to me like it almost made it impossible. And as I stated in my veto message, I was quite certain that there was going to be a challenge. There's actually a challenge to our existing law, which would have been modified significantly if that would have become law. And I said, you know, I thought they'd just gone too far. And I also thought that it would have been challenged. And who knows what the Ninth Circuit, how far back they would roll those the standards, because we already had one piece of legislation that came forward that the courts struck down as being too aggressive as far as limiting initiative. I believe in the people's right to have an initiative, but I think as I also stated, I don't want to be like Colorado or California, to where when you go in to vote, there's 20 pages of code changes on the ballot. And that's not any place that I necessarily think Idaho should go.
We're continuing our conversation with Idaho Governor Brad Little. We asked our listeners to join in the conversation, emailing us questions or comments for the governor. And we want to thank all of you who took the time to email us. And Governor, we'd like to take this next few minutes to just go through some of those questions. All right. Okay. So the first one is from Rebecca, and she sent us an email. And here was her question. I would like to ask how Governor Little proposes funding Idaho's 10% funding match for Medicaid expansion.
A great question, Rebecca. As I've stated all along, there's money in the corrections budget. There's money in the health and welfare budget. There's money in the CAT fund. And there's also a little money that comes out of the courts that currently goes in to cover some of these, this group of people. We will, I'm certain, get our IMD waiver, our mental health waiver from the federal government. All of those combined, a little bit of money out of each one of those budgets, plus the Millennium Fund, which we used, which is cigarette settlement money, which we used last year, all of those combined will pay our 10% match. So it'll be funded. There won't be additional general fund requests from me.
So Alicia sent us a question, and she says Representative Megan Blanksma is suggesting that we fund the 10% portion of Medicaid expansion when you have clearly given a better funding option that does not hamstring property owners through savings and interest from the Millennium Fund. How will you combat these obvious attempts to make Medicaid expansion a failure with voters? How will you address the Blanksma plan when it goes directly against your recommendations?
Well, I don't know that... I'm certain where Alicia's getting that. I know that some of the legislators, and Representative Blanks was one of them, believe that the counties who currently put a lot of money into patients that will be covered by Medicaid, basically are going to have additional revenue available to them that was going into that. And I know that some of the legislators are interested in harvesting part of that savings that exists at the county. But as I explained in Rebecca's previous question, we have the funding there. And, you know, that we'll look at the counties. It's all over the place. You know, some counties, it might be a bigger windfall, some would call it, gain than other counties. But we're going to have it funded this year.
And Alice has a question. She writes, Washington Representative Matt Shea has been removed from the Republican caucus by the GOP after an investigation indicating participation in domestic terrorism plots across the Inland Northwest. She says, my representative, Heather Scott, was named 8 times as a conspirator in these plots. What action will you take to protect Idaho against this extremist movement?
Well, I haven't read the report by the Washington State Legislature. It was paid for and done by the Washington State Legislature, pointed directly at one of their members, and they've removed that member from the caucus and removed him from committee assignments. And I know that Representative Scott was, all I know is what I read in the paper, but I don't know of any issues that I know of with Representative Scott where she fundamentally believes, she's a big proponent of the Second Amendment and some other things, but I don't know of any place in Idaho where she's violated any laws in Idaho.
Eric and Nell sent us an email about liquor. They say recently Governor Little stated that Idaho is the, quote, least regulated state in the nation. So given the pride that Idaho's Republicans take in the lack of government interference in business and personal liberties, please ask Governor Little why this attitude does not extend to liquor laws in the state of Idaho.
Eric is right. We do regulate liquor. It's actually a remnant from the Prohibition days in Idaho. There are some bills. All I can control is the rules. The laws are controlled by the state legislature, and I've been a proponent of them streamlining the laws. And if you go to the liquor code, she is exactly right. There are exemptions for golf courses and resorts and different venues, and it really doesn't make any sense. And there have been several attempts. There was one last year, and one Governor Otter did one, to make it to where, rather than write some complicated exemption, that the county would have more say in how the liquor licenses were issued. I don't disagree that we want to, you know, we don't want a liquor store or a liquor venue on every corner, but, you know, one of the best examples is Teton County. Very, very large resort community with a very small base, and then summer the population explodes. Everyone in Teton County complains that they can't grow the community because they can't put in restaurants because they can't get a liquor license. And it's a real problem in resort communities. I am a proponent of streamlining the liquor laws to where they make more sense so that, you know, general economic development can take place unfettered by laws. So I agree with her, but those are laws and not rules.
There's only so much you can do,
right?
Yeah. Jeremy wrote us with this question. Do you believe the current initiative laws are stringent enough as is, or would you favor more restrictions to the constitutionally protected initiative right? Do you believe the current standards are in compliance with Idaho's constitution? And I know we touched on this a little bit in the previous segment, but I did want to make sure we got Jeremy's question.
I do, but you know, some of the proposals in the bill I vetoed, like having a fiscal note, I agree with, and a lot of states do that. There's some components of a change that I would not have any problems with at all. I think it's, the process shouldn't be too complicated. People shouldn't be expected to have to go into the ballot box and have technical, comprehensive law changes that are really are best dealt through the legislative process and the rules process. But we still need to have that option. You know, Medicaid example is a great example. We had interim after interim that said, we need to address these people in the gap, but we just never could get there. And the citizens brought in an initiative and it was implemented. So I think that changes that make it to where it's more obvious to the voter, what they're voting on is a good factor. You know, I'm not a big fan of paid signature gathers, particularly when you have people come in from out of state and they get paid a big fee to get to gather signatures. I just, you know, my view of a republic, a democratic republic where people participate rather than paying somebody from out of state to participate, I'm just not a big fan of that.
And before I let you go, I would like to know, you've been in office now, I believe when this airs, it will be a year and 2 days. So, worst part of the job so far?
Telling my friends no.
Best part of the job?
Telling my friends yes.
Oh, no. These are too easy.
No,
come on.
No, really, I really love getting out. You know, the literacy initiative and getting out and going to these schools has been really good. I love all the things, the ceremonial things we do here in Boise, but I love getting out around the state and going into a community and the appreciation for them to know that their governor's there and to listen to them. The Capitol for a Day, which was actually started by Governor Andrus, had a robust Capitol for a Day that Governor Otter implemented. That's a great program. There's lots and lots of great parts of this job. Frankly, meeting with other governors and the common, whether they be Democrats or Republican, Western or Eastern, the problems that we address, whether the national governors, the Western governors, really rolling up our sleeves and trying to address problems, making our case to the federal government about how we can do a better job. Those are all rewarding parts of my job, but it's just a great job. But telling people no is not that hard if you have enough time to explain to them why you're telling them no. That if I do it for Gemma, I've got to do it for Joe and Fred, and you can see the problem there. But most people are pretty understanding.
What is your number one priority moving into your second year as governor?
Well, it's still education. The economy is so good right now. The problem of kids leaving isn't as great as it was, but we've got a lot of things to do to make that come to fruition. We've got to have, you know, our K-12 system, our higher education system. But one of the things that's really taken place in Idaho is the diversification of our economy. As one of our old traditional industries gets more efficient and puts people out of work, having some local entrepreneur right there that comes up with a new, either providing a new service or providing a new product and providing jobs, that's very rewarding because it adds resilience so that no matter what happens in the international area or the national area, Idaho will continue to prosper and our kids will be able to choose to stay here in Idaho.
I want to thank you for taking some time out of your day today and talking with us.
Thanks, Gemma.
We've been speaking with Idaho Governor Brad Little. And make sure you stay with us after Idaho Matters today because you will be able to listen live to the governor's State of the State address.
It's a great speech. Stay tuned.
And you said it's not going to be too long, right? I'm Gemma Gaudette. You're listening to Idaho Matters.